Hello everyone, happy Christmas and welcome to Shedcast number 3, The Great Earl and His Arm. Probably best to listen after you've listened to episode 201 of The History of England, though not a requirement. Now, to start at something of a tangent, when I was a lad at university in Scotland, I was in a sea of Celts, Irish as well as Scottish. The English were the butt of pretty much every joke and worse, where any opportunity presented itself. One of the gentler quips was a mockery of the English cricket team's policy of rummaging around the world in search of decent players, given that we couldn't find any back home. Essentially, if a decent South African cricketer, for example, had a grandmother who'd once seen an Englishman at the local supermarket, that was sufficient qualification to get them into the English team. I exaggerate for effect, of course, but not as much as you might think. How is this relevant, I hear you ask? Well, there I was, sitting in the shed writing episode 201 about Henry VII and Ireland, when I came across this chap, the great Earl of Kildare, and an interesting couple of wrinkles about the origin of the expression chancing your arm. So, I thought this would be a suitable short and quick podcast for Shedcasts. After all, you don't want 50-minute behemoths every time, do you? Let's mix it up a bit. So, essentially, here I am, stealing some Irish history under the banner of the History of England, at which point my mindless anecdote possibly becomes vaguely relevant. Or maybe not. But anyway, I have to say that the old English earls of Ireland are entirely relevant to English history, and so it's not a complete cheat. I'm not going to go over old ground, but just in case you've not done episode 201 yet, I talk about how in the 15th century Ireland is divided into three communities. The native Gaelic-Irish, the Anglo-Irish or Old English, the descendants of the 12th century Norman invaders, and the English-English, safely behind the walls of their towns and the Pale of Dublin. The Old English lords lived a life between those two communities almost, speaking both English and Gaelic, wearing Gaelic dress and applying Gaelic law when it was the right thing to do, and English dress and English law when that was appropriate. And just as the Gaelic clans fought incessantly, so too did the Old English, with the added mix that the King of England from time to time played politics, to raise up one or the other of the lords, or indeed bring down one or the other. One of those multi-generational rivalries between the Old English was between the Butlers and the Fitzgeralds. Both these families have the most extraordinarily old roots, and both survive to this day, which is quite a thing. The Fitzgerald family originates from one Gerald Fitzwalter, Norman of course. As I guess most of you know, the Fitz part of the name is a corruption of the French fils, son. And so Gerald Fitzwalter means Gerald, son of Walter. Now, for many centuries, the surname wasn't fixed. It changed for each generation. So my son would have been Henry FitzDavid rather than Henry Crowther. But at some point along the way, the names did get fixed as a surname, which in the Fitzgerald's case happened in 1238, when Maurice Fitzgerald had a son he called Maurice, who became Maurice Fitzgerald rather than Maurice Fitzmaurice, which sounds like a good decision to me. Well done, Maurice. They were Lords of Offaly, before one of them got himself promoted to Earl of Kildare in 1316 by virtue of fighting for Edward I in Scotland and resisting the invasion of Edward the Bruce. The Butlers, meanwhile, also of Norman ancestry, got their name from the office of Butler of Ireland, which they held for generations from their founder, Tybald Walter, until James Butler in 1328 became the first Earl of Ormond, created effectively by Roger Mortimer, though officially by Edward III, with the aim of creating some stability in Ireland after the fall of the Despensers. It's an example of the English throne building up particular families in a way very similar to the creation of the Marcher Lords on the borders of Wales, with consolidated landholdings and great autonomy to allow them to take war to the native Welsh or, in this case, Irish. You might remember the 5th Earl of Ormond, who was also the Earl of Wiltshire, whose rather unimpressive career in the Wars of the Roses, which mainly consisted of running away dressed as a monk, came to an end in 1461. Both Butlers and Fitzgeralds, though, had land and income from estates in England as well as in Ireland. So the great families of Ireland vied and jockeyed for position at times, and intermarried and cooperated at others. James Butler, the 4th Earl of Ormond, for example, kept Thomas, the 7th Earl of Kildare, out of his inheritance for years, through a spurious claim on the property. Since the Butler's landholding was hemmed in by the Kildares on one side and their related branch the Desmonds on the other, feelings frequently ran high and led to trouble. In the 14th and much of the 15th centuries, the Kildares were by no means the leading Anglo-Irish family. But the 7th Earl, after he had fought off the Butler's claim on his inheritance, consolidated their landholdings, became Lord Chancellor of Ireland. He established the Irish Parliament, and the principle of his independence in 1460, though that was to crash and burn under Henry VII's Poynings Law. And so we come to the object of the podcast, the great Earl Garrett Moore, the 8th Earl of Kildare, who used the inheritance his father gave him to become the dominant figure in Irish politics. His reputation was of the rough, square-jawed, illiterate warrior who slept with his sword and had no time for any namby-pamby art stuff. And for sure, his warrior credentials were pretty good, which we'll come to. The Howth Chronicles describes him as hardly able to rule himself when he were moved to anger, but then quickly appeased when it was all over. But the tales say of him that he learned to control his temper in later years, and without doubt he was a leader of men, this guy, a man of great courage and violence, if you want to put it like that. His reputation is as a superb politician and leader, with a subtle understanding of the nature of the relationships within Ireland and with the English crown and the realities that underpinned them. He led a series of military campaigns in his later years, mostly successfully. And despite that square-jawed military, I can only sign my name with a slash of the axe thing, he started an art collection, had a collection of books, and bequeathed £1,000 to establish a university college. If not quite a polymath, a man of broader interests than just politics and war, who recognised the wider responsibility he had as a magnate. Kildare was also a Yorkist, in the sense that his father essentially made a deal with the Duke of York when he was Lord Lieutenant of Ireland. Duke Richard of York was to let Kildare and Ireland pretty much rule themselves. In return, Kildare was to support the Yorkist cause. The Great Earl delivered. After the death of Duke Richard's son, Richard III, he supported the Yorkist pretender Simnel, an act of some optimism that could have meant an early bath. But the Great Earl knew that the English king was far away, and would never find it easy without vast effort to rule in Ireland without old English support, and therefore would hesitate to make retribution. And his judgment was spot on. However, he might well have had a wobbly about his judgment when Poynings came over at Henry VII's commission, Kildare was arrested, attainted, sent back to England, imprisoned in the Tower. It didn't look good, but still, Kildare's political judgment was absolutely right, on the money. Henry VII was clever enough to realise that without turning Ireland into a swamp of time, money, resources, he could only rule with the old English aristocracy's help. Famously, and probably apocryphally, Henry is supposed to have thrown up his arms and exclaimed, "If all Ireland cannot govern this earl, then let this earl govern all Ireland." Whether or not he said that, that is exactly what happened. And the result was something of a triumph for both Kildare and Henry. Henry helped give Kildare the wherewithal. So Kildare came back to Ireland from England with a new bride, always good, a cousin of the king who happened to bring income of £2,000 a year with her, even better. Kildare's son was also to marry an heiress. Kildare was himself then to extend his lands in Ireland by taking the allegiance of Irish clansmen as what was called swordland, conquering it basically, then regularising their relationship by taking their oath as English subjects. Kildare used both his private wealth and crown income to deliver effective rule for Henry. He made sure Warbeck was sent packing when he reappeared in Ireland in 1497, and Kildare was more active in extending English rule in Ireland than any leader for generations, whether or not you see that as a good thing. He was an innovator, reputedly the first person to import handguns into Ireland, which he used for his bodyguard, and to use artillery. He was, in fact, going to regret bringing gunpowder to Ireland, but more of that in a minute. He innovated also in the way he built an effective standing army for the crown in Ireland, while avoiding the drain on the royal purse, so hated by Henry. Whether by the ancient method of billeting troops on his tenants, or the even more ancient method of creating small holdings for his cavalry. Every summer, in campaign after campaign, Kildare visited parts of English Ireland that had been left abandoned for years. Galway in 1504, Limerick in 1510. He launched expeditions against the O'Brien, into Ulster capturing Belfast and Larne, and campaigning in the west of Ireland in Connacht. His servant wrote that as governor he set a new standard when compared with any of his predecessors, though I guess he would probably say that anyway. But he also pointed out that he forcibly constructed and built on the borders of the Irish in different parts many towns which had long since been laid waste by the Irish and needed replenishing with colonists and other buildings, and also diverse castles and bridges and other fortresses to the great profit and defence of the English. Eventually, this caught up with him. In 1513, on campaign, he was shot while watering his horses. It seems to have been one of those terribly common deaths, that is, it was the infection that killed him, rather than the gunshot itself, so he withdrew slowly with his army, but eventually died on the 3rd of September, 1513. Back then to that rivalry between the Fitzgerald Earls of Kildare and the Butler Earls of Ormond. Before Poyning arrived on the scene in 1495, Henry tried a different tack, a common tactic of the English crown. Given that Kildare had supported the Yorkist pretender, why not raise up the Kildare's ancient enemy, give them the upper hand, and then rule through them, and Kildare could be dropped in a deep hole somewhere late on a Saturday night. The obvious choice, then, was the Butler Earls of Ormond. Now, Kildare was not keen to be manipulated. While he withdrew his support for the English government in Dublin, he did not want to allow Henry to use the Butlers against him. And so we get this famous incident and one possible source of the expression, to chance your arm, i.e. give it a go, take a risk, with the implication that you're probably going to crash and burn. So, picture the scene with me. It's Dublin, 1492. Black James, the nephew of the Earl of Ormond, is a wild sort of lad, unsurprisingly given his name, and not much given to staying in on a Saturday night with some light embroidery. He's had a skinful and has met some of Kildare's soldiers, with the almost inevitable resulting argy-bargy, and a fight breaks out. The Ormond side is beaten and Black James runs for it with a few of his remaining followers. The great Earl turns up and the chase leads to the chapter house of St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin, where Black James barricades himself inside. Now, we all know the traditional outcome of this event. Black James's position is desperate. The Geraldine soldiers will get inside eventually. Black James will be killed, and we will have another blood feud on our hands. Maybe Henry VII will use the incident as an opportunity to put Kildare on trial, or levy a vicious bond, as he does with the Duke of Suffolk, in a similar situation, actually. This was the kind of thing that the scheming Henry wanted when he promoted the Butlers in favour of the Fitzgeralds. Kildare, remember, does not want to be manipulated and knows what's going on, and Kildare is in possession of a brain. He pleads with James to come out peacefully. He just wants his friendship. He will make all right. But Black James is hot for violence and vengeance, and he swears to sell his life dearly. He doesn't trust the evil Kildares. He'll never agree. So rather than beating the door down and all that entails, Kildare had a hole cut in the door. Then he thrust his arm through the door and begged James to shake his hand in peace. Now there's a risk for you. There's every chance that the fired-up James will bring his sword down and cut the great Earl's arm from his body, and revenge will be sweet. In fact, the door where this happens is called the Door of Reconciliation rather than the Door of Arm Severance. So you can probably guess the end of the story. Black James is convinced by this display of courage and trust. He reaches out and grasps the great Earl's arm. Further fuel is not thrown on the Butler-Geraldine feud. Kildare becomes Deputy Lord Lieutenant. Everyone lives in bright sunshine and happiness for the rest of their lives with the family of loving children who all love eating vegetables, and so on. And so there you go. The origin of the expression, chancing your arm. or not. As it happens, the Oxford English Dictionary is not convinced, as it often isn't. It thinks that if the expression had been created in 1492, we'd see it written down before the first time we actually see it written down, which is in the 1880s. So other possible explanations have therefore been advanced. One is that it's to do with the army, when you lose your stripes as a non-com, which are displayed on the arm, of course, by doing something daft, so chancing your arm. Not convinced about that. Or there's the idea that it's a naval expression. So if the cannon fails to fire, someone has to get the ball out by sticking their arm down the barrel. But maybe it's just a delayed action, so the cannon fires, taking your arm with it. A bit more plausible, I think. But I prefer the door of reconciliation, and so I shall choose to believe that one. The Kildares would continue their dominance for a while, through the 8th Earl's son, Thomas Fitzgerald, the 9th Earl, who seems to have been a chip off the old block, a bit impetuous, but a man of intelligence, learning and courage. Sadly, his life ended in failure and he fell foul of Mouldwarp, Henry VIII himself, and died in the Tower of London. And indeed, the butler star then waxed again. Just to end with the great Earl Garrett More, then, he's an impressive bloke. Maybe the biggest accolade is that both English and Gaelic writers recognised his greatness and praised his career and life. Let us end with the Gaelic Annals of Ulster, with my apologies for ducking the use of the proper Gaelic terms. I tried, I just could not get it, much as I practised. So foreigners are the Old English, by the way. In power, fame and estimation, he exceeded all the foreigners, conquered more territory from the Gaels, built more castles for the foreigners, raised more castles of the Gaels, kept better justice and law, and gave most of his own substance to the men of Ireland. Not a bad recommendation from the men against whom you'd waged war. That's it. Thank you, everyone, for supporting Shedcasts. Have a great week full of fun and laughter.